serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Hi, I'm WILL radio station manager Jay Pierce. There are many worthwhile organizations deserving financial support this time of year, and we're grateful that you would consider WILL. Listener support makes news and information programs on WILL possible. It's easy to make your gift online at willpledge.org or call us at 217-244-9455. Thank you.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. In this hour of the show, we will look back to an event that captured the attention of the nation, became a national story back in 1972. It's the Sunshine Mine disaster. Just about everybody who lived in the town of Kellogg, Idaho, had at least one family member who worked or had worked in the Sunshine Mine, and everybody knew just how dangerous it was to be a miner. However, no one could quite believe it when a fire broke out in the mine. This was May 2nd of 1972. Because of the kind of mine that it was, and we'll explain that, it seemed that a fire was unlikely, if impossible. But it happened, and it burned for a week. It made national news, and of the 93 men who were trapped in the mine by the fire, only two survived. This morning, we'll get the story as we talk with investigative journalist Greg Olson. He's written a book all about the Sunshine Mine disaster. It's titled The Deep Dark, Disaster and Redemption in America's Richest Silver Mine. It's published by Crown. He is a journalist and investigative reporter, has been for more than two decades. He's gotten a number of awards for his work. He's the author of seven nonfiction books, including one that was a bestseller titled Abandoned Prayers. Mr. Olson, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm not doing too bad today.
Well,
thank you.
I appreciate you giving us some of your time. You first, I believe, actually heard about this story when it happened?
That's right. I was a teenager when it happened and living here in the Seattle area where I live now. And it was on the news. It was obviously a huge story. And every day it was grimmer and grimmer. The body count went up and up and up. And you know what really brought it home for me was that my father, who was a salesman, was driving through the Kellogg area about the time of all these funerals that they had, and he came home and gathered us boys together and said, you know, you aren't going to believe this, I saw a coffin in the back of a pickup truck. And we said, what do you mean? And he said, well, there was this coffin bouncing up and down in the back of this pickup truck, and, you know, we were just astounded by that, and my dad said, you know, it's because they didn't have enough hearses in Kellogg to take all the guys to their final resting places. So that image really stuck with me and made it sort of a personal connection for me, always wondering about that town and that place and what happened there in 1972. Hmm.
So was there anything specific that made you now, as a journalist, want to go back and spend significant amount of time, and you certainly did, and talk to a lot of people to paint this picture of what happened, how the people reacted, the effect that it had on the town, ultimately the effect that it had on mining?
It's kind of funny, David. You know, it's one of those stories that really did stick with me. And every time we would drive back east, you know, to Nebraska, where my family was from, we would pass through on I-90, pass through Kellogg and Wallace, the towns where this was a huge impact. And I kind of wondered about those folks and those people and what happened. And I was astounded, you know, 30 years later to find out that no one had ever bothered to write about it. It was such a huge event, and as maybe we'll get into later, changed mining forever.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly changed the lives of hundreds of people in a little town.
The mine is now closed.
That's right.
It was closed in 2001. At one time, though, this was one of the most productive silver mines ever?
Yeah, it still is. It still is considered America's richest silver mine. Like, maybe, it's probably now 350 million ounces of silver have been hauled out of that mine. And it's a very deep mine, David. It's almost a mile underground at about 6,000 feet below the surface. So it's a big, massive mine, and it's got a very high-quality silver ore, tetrahedrite, which is the best. A lot of the mines in the area lean more toward lead ore. So this was a very prolific, productive, rich mine, made lots of people millions.
How long did the mine operate?
It operated almost a century before they shut it down in 2001 because of escalating prices. Although I will tell you that development work looks good right now, and they're pumping water out of it to probably reopen in a year or two.
It's for someone who has not done this, it's very difficult to imagine what conditions in the mine would be like. And actually, I think that you do a good job of describing it. Just trying to wrap your head around the idea that of how deep it was. I think I wrote this down, that the deepest working level of the mine was 5,600 feet.
Right.
Is that right?
That's right.
And just, I can't, even trying to put myself in the frame of mind of thinking about what it would be like to be in the mine at that level and just think about the fact that all that rock was over your head. I'm not sure how, what kind of psychological impact that, I'm sure some people couldn't cope.
I'll tell you what, it is very strange. I look at it and I tell people, you know, to get a sense for how deep this is, you know, think of a local landmark in your community that you know the height of. In ours, here in Seattle, it's the Space Needle. So, you know, stand at the base of the Space Needle and look up. That's 605 feet tall, the Space Needle. It's 10 times that height that you're underground. I mean, is that amazing?
Yeah.
You know, and I've been underground a couple of times, and I'll tell you that there is this, it's an otherworldly type feeling going down that deep. It's hot, it's wet, and you do have this sense that maybe a little feeling of impending doom because you are down there in the guts of the earth.
Tell us a little bit about the town of Kellogg. What's it like?
Well, you know, Kellogg right now is a, you know, they're a sad little town in a lot of ways. Mining was their lifeline. It had been for about a century, and there are a number of very good mines or had been very successful mines in that area. But, you know, a lot of mining has gone overseas, and where environmental concerns are not as stringent, and prices for labor are lower. So they've really been in a real tailspin over the last probably 20 years. And hoping now that they'll become a, you know, a ski slope and a tourist attraction. But I will tell you, it's a mining town. There's no question, and the people who live there are damn proud of that. I mean, they want to be miners. They don't want to be ski lift operators or restaurant workers. They really want to get down there, get dirty, get that ore out, and live that kind of a life that their grandfathers and their dads did.
I think that's an interesting point, because when you ask the question why it is people do this, one reason has to be, well, they do it for the money, and that the money was good and made perhaps better than what you could have made doing other things. But there also seemed to be this issue of mining, the association of mining with people's identity, the fact that mining as an occupation ran in families. Yes, some people did it because it was a job, but other people did it either because they got some sort of strange, it was strangely exciting, or that and the fact that maybe their uncle was a miner, their dad was a miner, the grandfather was a miner. There was just this sense that that was so much a part of them that it wasn't
right.
A question that they were also miners.
You're right about that. There was a family legacy and a heritage there that we often, you know, forget. We think, and, you know, there are a lot of places in our country where people do these very tough, dangerous jobs, and you do find that it does run in the family lineage, that they have done it for, you know, 50 years, 100 years, whatever. What I learned from doing the book was, you know, in America, even today, how much of a product you are by where you come from. And Kellogg, Idaho, if you were a teenage boy in high school, you might not study too hard. You might figure that, hey, I'm going to get a good job anyway when I'm going to get and go underground, and I'll make, you know, even in 1972, they were making $50,000 a year, which is huge. Living was good and fun, and you hit the nail on the head. The element of danger, this macho subculture, is definitely a part of mining. And, you know, these guys love being a little bit on the edge every day.
Well, as I mentioned, I think everyone is well aware of the fact that being a miner is one of the most dangerous occupations there is. So they certainly had to be aware every day they went underground. They just had to be in some part of their head. There had to be this idea that something really bad could happen and they could die. How did they think about that? Or did they really not think about that?
I will tell you, a lot of them did think about that. And especially the women, the wives, all thought about it. They all thought, you know, if the phone rings during the day, during shift, it might be a bad call. So it definitely went along with the women. Of course, the men, they put up with it, and there was this idea that you know, I cheated death today. I made a good living, and I got out alive. Definitely that was part of the feeling, which also made it, you know, the other end of the spectrum, they played hard when they got out of the mine, too, because every day was like a celebration that you know, you worked your butt off, you made a lot of money, and you risked your life a little bit. So definitely that's part of it.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is investigative journalist Greg Olson, and we are talking about the story of the Sunshine Mine disaster. It took place in Kellogg, Idaho, in May of 1972. It was a silver mine. A fire broke out in the mine. Almost half of the workers made it out, but 93 men were trapped inside, and 91 of them were killed. The story is told in his book, The Deep Dark, and is published by Crown. It's been out for a little while now. If you want to read the book, you head out to the bookstore and look for it. Here on the show, also, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, the bulk of the book, obviously, is devoted to a very kind of detailed, almost moment-by-moment account of what happened. And we can only give a sort of a general sketching out of what happened, but I want to do that. What were the first signs for people in the mine that there was a problem, that something was going on?
That's right. There, in the very beginning, even with the graveyard shift coming off, they did smell a little bit of smoke that morning on May 2nd, 1972. And they reported it, and whether that really went anywhere or not, we don't know. Probably around 11 o'clock that morning, during the middle of shift, there was this smell of smoke that some of the foremen had went to source. They wanted to find out where the smoke was coming from. Nobody was really alarmed because, you know, this is a hard rock mine, not a coal mine. Coal mines are notorious for fires, obviously, because coal is a fuel and it burns. But in a hard rock mine, like Sunshine Mine or the other mines in the Coeur d'Alene Mining District, it was, you know, there's timber. There's certainly lots of timber underground, you know, used to brace the mine and shore up the ribs and all this stuff. But there really isn't, at least there's not believed a fuel source. So when there's a fire, it's usually extinguished. In many cases, there's no evacuation. So they looked for the fire, and probably within 45 minutes of that first experience of that smelling of the smoke, they were into a disaster because of really a toxic cloud went through that mine and trapped everybody.
Yeah, and that's really, I guess, one of the sad things, and one of the things that you see as the disaster starts to develop, and everyone in the mine seems to be asking himself that same question: well, what's burning? Where's this fire coming from? Because as you say, they had this mindset that said, in this kind of a mine, there's nothing to burn. So it's not something we need to be really concerned about because, as you say, because it's not a coal mine, because, yes, there are sections of the mine that have these old timbers in them, but it's wet down here. So there was never, until things got really bad, there was not this sense of urgency.
Right. Within the community, even when word got out there was a fire, you know, there was, of course, a big exodus of people from the town up to the mine to see what was going on, but nobody was really worried then either. They were thinking, just as the men underground were thinking, well, it's probably a motor that caught on fire, or maybe there's a shack on fire on the surface or something. It can't be that big of a deal. So definitely there was this complacency, this idea that a fire in a hard rock mine was not going to do much damage or even hurt anybody. But, you know, it sadly turned out to be the second worst hard rock mine disaster in our country's history.
And if initially they had responded differently right at the first sign of trouble, could they have gotten everybody out, and would we not now be talking about 91 men being killed?
You know, I do believe, you know, there's so many things. If you've read the book, you know, there's so many little things that could have been different, sure, that maybe could have saved more lives. The equipment was faulty, the self-rescuers they used. Evacuation was, you know, confused, and it's a mile underground, so it takes a while to get guys out. The warning system failed. They use a stench warning system to alert miners that there's a problem in order to get them evacuated, and that didn't work. So there were a lot of things, but I do believe, in my heart, I do believe that if they had acted sooner and had evacuated sooner, we would have saved probably at least maybe 50 more lives. The key to the whole thing was, David, and as you know, is that it was the day of the shareholders' meeting. So all of the executives, all of the top mine people were away from the mine site when the fire broke out, and none of the underlings knew or felt they had the power to call for that evacuation right away. So they did kind of mess around a little bit trying to find that smoke when they really should have just sucked up the authority and said, let's let these guys out now.
Yeah. Well, so eventually at some point, the decision was made to evacuate the mine.
Right.
Why, though, still did we are we talking about a number of people not being able to get out?
Yeah, when they evacuated the mine, well, the whole problem is, you know, you're 1,000 feet down to get to one working level, then another 1,000 feet down to get to where the production levels are. And when the hoistman in the middle of that level, the middle of the mine, and when he was incapacitated due to the smoke, it trapped everybody that was below him, and that was where a lot of the production was going on. So once they lost the hoistman at about, you know, the 3,700-foot level, they were in trouble, and there was really no getting everybody out.
Hmm. The maybe we're jumping here to the conclusion, and I don't want to, I don't know how you feel about ultimately giving too much away in the book, but apparently what happened here was that there was a polyurethane foam that was used in a lot of mines at the time. And I guess it might be much like the kind of thing that people use for insulation in their homes to prevent air infiltration, that was sprayed various places as a sealant that was thought to be fireproof. It was thought that it would not burn, even though apparently there was some evidence even at this time from mines in Britain that, in fact, it would burn. But that no one knows exactly how the fire got started, but I guess the thinking goes that somehow, however it got started, this stuff did burn, and it produced a very toxic smoke, and that's what it was that, and that in conjunction with the fact that the air system in the mine really wasn't doing what it was supposed to, didn't take that toxic smoke out. That's what it was that killed these guys.
Right. It was this contamination of the intake-outtake air system that was short-circuited, so the toxic smoke that was being produced by this polyurethane foam and the wood and other things that were burning was forced through the mine instead of, exhausted from the mine, and that's what really pushed. I mean, some guys died instantly. They died right where they stood. I mean, later when they took some readings of the smoke and the gases, it was off the meter. They couldn't even measure it. It was so beyond the calibrations of anything they'd ever recorded. So it was deadly, deadly smoke, and it came through there like a tornado. There's no question about that. But even so, there were opportunities, I would say, where more lives could have been saved if a quicker evacuation had been made, or if the self-rescuers, which would be these handheld mouthpieces that would be, you know, they were good for about a half an hour, and the guys could breathe through them. If all of those were in working order, perhaps some more guys could have gotten out too.
Yeah. Well, that's another issue. The miners were provided with this kind of safety equipment that would allow them, as you say, to be able to breathe in case there was some kind of problem. Although it seemed that they didn't work well, the miners weren't trained in how to use them, and that even if they had worked, you know, maybe they wouldn't have been adequate to the task.
Yeah, the amazing thing about those self-rescuers, you know, Sunshine Mine was only one of two in Idaho that had them. They were not required in hard rock mines. They were required in coal mining where, you know, fires are more prevalent. So it was unusual that Sunshine had them. But again, this whole idea of not being too worried about a fire, the guys, they would steal these self-rescuers and use them, you know, to spray paint their cars. They would, mess around with them. They didn't respect them or care for them because they didn't think they were valuable. So the fact that Sunshine had them did save a lot of lives, but many were in poor shape, corroded, and didn't work when they really needed to.
Yeah, and one of the crucial points where you really needed to have somebody have that kind of protection was the guy who was working the elevator, essentially, the thing that moved the miners up and down in the mine.
That's right. And that, you know, there's a huge legacy there, and I don't know if you want to get into that now, what happened after the fire and how they changed things, but definitely having a hoist operator or the elevator operator in a contained environment with its own air source is one of the fallouts from that fire. They now require that in all mines, and you're not going to have a guy die at the controls like they did last in 1972.
Yeah, I suppose if you want to try to find some kind of upside to the story, it is, as you say, a number of changes were made in the way that mines operate, and can it be said that this kind of mine is safer today than it was then as a result of this accident?
There's no question about it. I believe many, many more lives have been saved. I mean, those guys that died in May of 72 didn't die for nothing. They definitely, you know, it was a big bell ringer and changed hard rock mining and all of mining, really, to make it a safer job, and it's not as dangerous, really, as it was. There are other jobs now far more dangerous than mining. So American mines are safer because of sunshine. They have the requirement of self-rescuers that now last an hour. They now have check-in, check-out procedures. In Sunshine's day, no one knew who was underground, so that made it hard to find out where they were and who was there. And now that's required. And, of course, the oxygen and places of refuge in the mine should a fire break out. There are now stations that people can go to be, you know, bulkheaded in and protected from the smoke, which is going to be the main reason that someone might die. So there are lots of good things that in the past, you know, mining and our government was all about commerce, and after Sunshine, it became about safety as well, which was great.
Well, again, we're almost at our midpoint here to just very quickly reintroduce. We're talking with Greg Olson. He's the author of 7 nonfiction books. He's a journalist and investigative reporter, has been so more than 2 decades, and his book that we're talking about here this morning is The Story of the Sunshine Mine Disaster. It's titled The Deep Dark, Disaster and Redemption in America's Richest Silver Mine. It's published by Crown. Is out now in bookstores if you want to read it. And questions here are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. How did people on the surface, the family members of the miners, first get word that something really serious was going on?
You know, like I said, they did hear the fire, and, you know, it's a small town. It's a small community, and you know, everybody knows everybody or has been married to somebody at a time or two. You know, they're all related in some way. So when word got out there was a fire at Sunshine, a little encampment kind of grew by the portal there. And I would say, you know, probably at its height of the disaster, 200 or 300 people were waiting there. Now, the company knew a lot of the guys had already died. They'd seen the bodies, but they kept the focus on this rescue effort and not a body recovery effort for about 9 days. So it was tragic. I mean, these people were waiting, they were hoping, and they were praying that, you know, their man, their dad, their husband, their father would come out alive, when in the very beginning it was known how severe it was.
Yeah. Certainly there are some heroes in this story among the miners, but there are also a lot of people who didn't exactly cover themselves with glory. And the people who ran the mine were among them. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, what about fair, just criticisms that could have been made of the mine managers, both those who were on the scene locally, who were the mine managers right there, and then those people who were running the company, those the people who were at the corporate headquarters that would have been a long way away from Kellogg. I know.
Right. The corporate, you know, the mine at that time was owned by outsiders, people from New York, which was different. The history of the mine had always been Northwest ownership, and many times the owners lived in town. So it was at the beginning of this time, really, in our country where, you know, out-of-town people were taking over little companies and running them from, 1,000 miles away or 2,000 miles away. So there definitely was a different feeling. The people that worked on the surface at the mine every day were, you know, at some level had miners' hearts. They definitely understood the business. They understood the men and the dangers and the feeling of going underground, because they did every day too. But the guys outside of that, the guys that, you know, the number crunchers and those folks back in New York, I hate to dog them so much, but they were more concerned with the money. And even when the fire broke out, you know, several people heard the president at the time, you know, remark that sunshine was going to come out of this smelling like a rose, because mineral prices would go up with the shutdown, and insurance would pay for the lost production. So there was even that kind of a thing going on, where the people who worked there, all they could think about was, you know, they were going to be burying half their town.
That's that comment by the mine president, it's just hard to fathom someone could have been that callous when we're talking about something here that could result in loss of life, that they would actually be saying, well, you know, if the mine shut down for a while, that's good for the price of silver.
Right.
It's did that person actually know what was going on, and did they in their mind have at one time the fact that miners could die, but also the other fact that that could be good for business?
Well, they did know at that time that five had died already for sure. Now, whether they knew, you know, that the next 25 were already dead and they were going to find them, I don't know. But yeah, that guy could have used some media coaching, I guess. But yeah, they were that callous, and they were not, you know, they flew in on their airplane and you know, gave their press conferences and then flew away. So they certainly weren't part of the fabric of that community.
Well, what about the people who were the managers who were there in Kellogg on that level? I think in the book you talk about the fact that probably they weren't local people either. They were people who were rising up through the company. This was a stop along the way of their career. So perhaps they didn't have a huge stake in that town or that mine, and may indeed have somewhere in their minds had this idea that, you know, I certainly don't want to do anything that's going to cause any problems for my career, that's going to go on my record. After all, I want to go on someplace else from here and eventually work my way up the corporate ladder. Did that affect their approach to dealing with the problem when it was obvious there was a problem?
Yeah, I think it did. I think these guys, who the mine managers, they were, I'm thinking of Marvin Chase, and I want to say something about these, you know, it may be a little bit inept, some of them, but none of them were nefarious people. They were, you know, doing what they thought was right, and I don't think they made any decisions that cost any lives or anything like that. But they weren't as familiar with their mine as they should have been. In fact, when the disaster started, there was an outreach of support, and lots of different mining officials came from other mines in the region, and they knew the mine better than those guys that were running Sunshine at that time. So there was a lot of confusion. The maps were out of date. There was no clear, you know, game plan in the very first probably 48 hours of the event. So in a disaster, not everybody's a leader. Not everybody is able to rise to that occasion to help and to rally the troops. And we definitely had nice guys, but they were not really the guys that were going to, you know, bust some heads and get something going. So definitely a different feel, I would say.
There's certainly among the miners, there were heroes and people who had gotten out and then decided to turn around and go back to try to help those people who were still in the mine. Is there anyone who stands out particularly as just an exceptional individual for how he conducted himself?
I think there are so many of them. I think of, Don Beaner, who was a nipper, which is the lowest level in the mine. It's basically someone that, you know, carries out the buckets they use for toilets underground. So, I mean, it's terrible, but he, you know, not a job anybody would want, but he did that job, and he got out of the mine, and when they were looking for a rescue crew to go in after several guys, you know, Don went along, and Don, you know, he made a mistake. One of the guys that was coming out of the smoke, one of the last guys coming out of the smoke down on 3100 level, Don and the rescue party met him there, and Don took off his mask, gave it to this guy to give him a shot of air, and then Don succumbed and died, and becoming really the only rescue worker in Idaho history to die during an event. You know, Don was a great guy, and I think selfless, which were a lot of those guys. There were every single guy that, you know, there were lots of stories of a dad, you know, leaving a son underground or trying to go back to get him, or partners, you know, these guys. The interesting thing about writing this book and meeting these people was to see how deeply they cared for one another. You know, every single guy that I interviewed, I'm not kidding you, every guy, now I thought these would be the toughest old grizzled miner folk I'd ever meet. Instead, they were the most tender-hearted guys. They all cried, without exception. Every guy cried, telling me the story of what had gone on that day. So there's a lot, there's a huge bond there. And I can just see, and I can imagine them, because they told me, you know, standing out there feeling so helpless and doing anything they could to get back in there and get their buddy out, and they would have done it.
I think among the groups that I'm sure people in Kellogg do not feel fondly about, it's the news media, because of the way that reporters and media people conducted themselves when they came in to cover this event. How did people respond to you as a journalist, even now, this many years later, wanting to tell this story and hoping that they would open up to you and tell you, go back and tell you about a lot of really painful stuff?
I'll tell you, that's interesting, because when I first started it, several people said, oh, they won't talk to you. They you know, in 1972, a UPI reporter posed as a Red Cross worker to get in there and get the story. And, you know, he was handing out blankets, but he was also secretly interviewing people and writing stories about what was going on inside the rescue effort. That hurt a lot of people and angered them. And even 30 years later, they would still talk about that journalist like he had done some terrible, terrible deed, you know, in order to get the story. So I thought, oh, you know, what am I going to get? But I will tell you that if you wait long enough, there are, you know, and nobody asks about it, because no one had asked about that Sunshine Mine fire. I came and I felt like a hero, because so many people told me, they said, thank God somebody cares about what happened to us. You know, we hear about all these other tragedies in our country. We hear about, you know, whatever, you know, the bomb exploding in Oklahoma. We hear about, you know, 9/11, all these things that happened. But little old, you know, Kellogg, Idaho, a tiny, tiny place, suffered this huge tragedy. It was big news in 1972, and then it faded away forever. So they were grateful that somebody got in there to tell their story. And I will tell you that a lot of them told me things they've kept inside for really for 3 decades. So I feel it was a privilege and an honor, really, to get a chance to go in there and get it all down before it was too late, because a lot of them, you know, they're in their 60s now.
And you said this was the second worst hard rock mine disaster ever?
That's right.
In terms of the number of people who were killed.
And fatalities, yeah. Right. In 1917, there was a worse one, almost a couple hundred in Montana and Granite Mountain, which was a shaft fire. But you know, this is certainly, you know, I consider this the worst hard rock mining in modern times, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. There's another sort of group here I want to ask you about, and that's the government, the federal government, and how it is that people from the federal government responded to this, and whether it was helpful or it was not.
Yeah, you know, I talked to, of course, some people associated with the present mining safety branch of the government, which is, then they were helpful and everything, but I really focused on what the people in the town were thinking and what do they recall, and it was definitely for them an us-against-them type feeling. They felt like these bureaucrats, at that time it was the Bureau of Mines, was the agency, you know, that they were people who came out in these suits and they, you know, were afraid to go underground and they didn't know anything about underground, but they were trying to take over the rescue effort, and it caused some bitterness. I mean, there's definitely a difference between being a miner working underground and a guy that sits at a desk all day in D.C., and that's what they had. So I would say that, you know, Idaho is a different kind of place, as you know. I mean, every time Idaho is in the news, it's some weird little story about some, you know, survivalist or whatever. Idaho definitely is that kind of a place where they don't want outsiders coming in and telling them what to do.
We have a caller here. We have a couple. And again, I want to make sure people who are listening know we're certainly open to questions, like always. Our guest, Greg Olson, we're talking about his book, The Deep Dark, the story of the Sunshine Mine disaster. It took place in Kellogg, Idaho in May of 1972. This was a silver mine. 91 miners were killed when a fire broke out in the mine. It's a very, very powerful and engaging story. So if you want to read it in great detail, you can look for The Deep Dark. Otherwise, here we have callers. Let's talk with one, and that's someone listening in Urbana, and it's line number two. Hello.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. To what extent were your informants in your investigation still conscious of the history of Big Bill Haywood and the Western Federation of Miners and the IWW, and thanks for your work. I'll let you go. Thanks.
I really focused on the more, and if you'll read the story, I hope, and you'll see, it's more focused on the community level and what these guys and the women and the children were doing during that really a 10-day period when the disaster unfolded. So I didn't really get into too much of that, but so that's primarily the focus of the story.
Was the, I mean, is there a union angle to this?
Well, they were part of the steelworkers union, is what the mining people were in Kellogg and in the hard rock mining industry. And they didn't feel that, you know, there's not, at that time anyway, I would say they thought there was really no relationship with, you know, the steelworkers and the mining folks, that the jobs were too different, but it was, at that time, that's the union that they had.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. How was it, maybe this is going off on a sideline, but how was it that they weren't in the mine workers union?
I think the mine workers union, I think at that time, I don't know, I can't answer that. All I know is they were with the steelworkers.
They were with the steelworkers.
Yeah. What,
did the union do anything to try to help the families of those people, the survivors who had lost family members?
The union was great. The union really worked hard to try to get, obviously, to improve the safety measures of the mine, and had been for, you know, at least a decade before the fire. So the union was definitely involved. And, you know, I talked to these union guys, and, of course, they blame the company. They blame the company's greedy owners, you know, for all that had transpired. But the union was very active. And there's a big, you know, I mean, labor problems within the Silver Valley, which is what they call this part of Idaho, have been rife for, you know, 50 years. I mean, there's been car bombs. I mean, it's been everything. So it's definitely a very active union environment. There's no question.
Hmm. We talked a little bit about the about what happened, about the fact that there was a fire, that it wasn't the kind of thing that was really thought to be a big risk in this kind of mine, but in fact it was, and that a combination of things, the toxic materials that could burn and produce toxic smoke, an air handling system that wasn't doing what it was supposed to, maybe a warning system that didn't work to warn the men, the fact that they were provided with some safety equipment, but it might not have been enough, it might not have worked very well, they didn't really know exactly how to use it, and might have had this very casual attitude because, again, going back to the issue of the kind of mine that it was, they might have thought, well, you know, there's a lot of bad things that could happen to us in this mine, but a fire is not the kind of thing that we have to worry about. All that stuff added together to create this problem. And we had this toxic smoke in the mine. A lot of miners were killed in a relatively short period of time. Some people were maybe killed right away. They were killed right where they were. Didn't even have the time to even think about getting out. So a lot of people were killed. And so we had this, over this period of time, this rescue effort that was going on, even though the company knew that at least some of those miners that were down there were dead. Two guys got out, and they were there in the mine for almost, a week, for a week.
Right. They were there 8 days underground. And
how did those two guys that survive?
Those guys, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, about their survival. One of them is that they were in the right place at the right time for what could have been a tragic reason. I mean, the smoke was going through the mine. They were down on 4,800 level, which was one of the deeper levels. And one of the fellows, Tom Wilkinson, passed out. His buddy Ron Flory carried him back to this borehole that had been finished a week before the fire. It was about a 1,000-foot borehole that would eventually be a shaft. And it had it was bringing in some fresh air, and he took his buddy back there, and they decided, well, you know, this is a pretty good place. Let's go back and get the other guys. And when they went back, everybody else on their level was dead. So it was lucky that Tom had passed out and that Ron had carried him back. And they, you know, they lived on water. They got the lunches from the dead guys on their level, and really had nothing much to do but wait, drink water, braid blasting wire. They even whittled a checker set. I mean, they did what they could to wait it out, hoping that the guys on the surface would finally get down to them.
How does a person maintain their sanity in a situation like that, maintain their optimism, continue to hold on to the feeling that they're going to survive and they're going to be rescued?
You know, Tom, I'll tell you what, I think Ron was a little bit fragile there underground. Ron was sort of losing it, and Tom was afraid that Ron was going to do something crazy, because at a couple of points, you know, Ron said, well, I'm going to climb out of here. And we're talking climb 1,000 feet, okay, you know, on these ladders that are rickety as heck. It's an unsafe situation for sure. We don't know where the smoke is really coming from. So, I mean, you don't know what you're going to be climbing into something worse. But, you know, Ron was determined. I mean, he wanted out of there, and he went nuts a couple of times. But what they did was they said, you know, we took turns trying to keep each other up, talking about, you know, our wives, talking about girls, talking about what we were going to eat when we got out. We talked about everything. And one guy would sleep, the other guy would stay awake. You know, they just tried to, you know, just within their hearts, they knew someday they're going to come get us. Now, either they're going to get down to this level because all this silver ore is down here. They're going to come down here. Are they going to get down here in time to find us dead or alive? That was the question.
Mm-hmm.
And it was dark. That's the other thing. I mean, they had one lamp between the two of them. So, you know, I've been underground, and I'll tell you, they do that little demonstration where you turn off your lamp, mm-hmm. and you've never seen darkness like you've seen it underground.
For the people who lost family members, what has the aftermath been like for them? And are there people who were so emotionally scarred by the loss that they really, truly never recovered?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I learned that, you know, I always tell people, you know, I'm a baby boomer. I've grown up in this era where we can be anything we want to be and we can get past whatever that befalls us. And I've learned from this experience that, you know, we can't. Not always. There are lots of people who never moved past 1972, just couldn't. And those were people who lost, you know, a husband or a dad or three family members, whatever. There were many that lost multiple people within their family group. So they think about it every day. They, you know, one woman, she took all the photographs down of every other family member in her household and stuck up her dead husband's photo everywhere and put his cap lamp and cap in the back of her pickup and drove around, I swear to God, for 30 years with that thing in the back seat so that, you know, as a tribute to him.
Hmm.
And when I finished the book, you know, Betty Johnson, I took it to her. Her husband Gene had died. He was very heroic underground. He was one of those guys who sacrificed a lot to get men out. And, you know, I gave Betty the book, and I said, I hope you like it. I think there's a tribute here in some way to what Jean did. And she said, I'm just glad I don't have to live that much longer. I'm 80 years old, and I'm not going to live much longer. And I'm glad you wrote the book, but I just want to go home to him, even today.
Is there still a lot of anger directed towards the company?
Here's the interesting thing. No, because the miners' wives, you know, that's one exception. Betty is one that blames the mine. She doesn't blame the mine, by the way, for killing her husband. She blames and is angry at the mining company because they called her on the phone to say he was dead instead of coming to her house. All of the women who worked, you know, had husbands that worked underground, knew there was a risk. Their dads had been miners, too, for most of them. So it was a cultural thing where they were all aware of it. So when disaster struck, nobody really blamed Sunshine. In fact, very few sued the mining company. Most were, you know, they took their $5,000 and they, you know, tried to start a new life, though many failed at that. You know, married right away after the fire to try to get a husband or a father for their children. So, I mean, there wasn't a lot of anger directed at the mining company because death is sometimes the price of silver for these folks.
How long after the disaster did it take for the mine to start operating again?
About 8 months. It opened up 8 months later in December of that year and ran until its closure in 2001. So there were a couple of times when it came to a halt because of labor strikes, but pretty much went back to business as usual.
Hmm. Those two guys that survived, did they go back?
One did. One went back mining. The other worked for the Forest Service in Idaho. They, you know, the Ron Flory, the guy who went mining, he's in his late 50s now, probably, I think, close to 60 today. But he you know, he was injured badly in an auto accident after probably 10 years ago. He'd still be underground today if he could. He loved it. I mean, he is one of those people who told me, he said it was, he felt it was a privilege to work in the underground because it was a place where few people go, and you had to be a certain kind of guy to be able to put up with it. And he found some honor in that, that was something to be proud of.
Hmm. I think that that's kind of thing that would be hard for a lot of people to understand, but having heard that maybe does go some way to explain why anybody would do it in the first place.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've always thought, at first I thought it was just the money, because here are these people with no education making, you know, $50,000 or $60,000 a year, which would be what maybe a doctor might make in 1972. So they were making big money. And I thought, you know, why would they do it? And then I kind of know now, you know, I work in different companies, and I know now that there's a culture underground. There's a family underground. These guys are close. They, you know, joke and they play together, and they're more brothers than probably my brother and I really are. They're just, it's its own world. And if you're in that and you embrace that, it's probably not a bad deal.
We talked about the fact that there were, that at one point there were 93 men were trapped. These two men got out. So 91 died.
Right.
And I'm sure that a lot of people were happy to see those two guys come out, but that there also were a lot of mixed feelings when people lost family members, when the fact that these two guys survived, and I'm sure there were probably people who said, you know, why not my husband? Why these guys?
David, you're right about that. Even today, people grouse about that a little bit. Why did those two guys get out? My husband was a better man. I had 10 children. You know, he only had one. You know, why would that be? I mean, and I think that's been tough, particularly for Ron Flory, who lives in Smelterville, which is the next town over from Kellogg. He's lived there his whole life, and I swear when he walks through town, there's always that awareness from people that he got out. He was one of the two, and that hasn't been easy for him, I can assure you that.
Hmm. We talked back in the first part of the show about what the thinking is about what happened, about what, maybe not the exact cause, what was the initial thing that touched out off the fire, but what happened. Was it really that difficult to determine precisely what caused the fire?
Yeah, well, you want to know what, you know, here's the question. Everybody wants to know what touched it off, and you don't seem to be concerned with that. But people do want to know, you know, was somebody smoking where they shouldn't have been? Was it arson? You know, there was a FBI investigation into arson. There were all sorts of, you know, there was a guy welding not far from where they believe the fire ignited, so he could have accidentally touched it off. People do focus on that. All we can say is we know what made it a disaster. We know the polyurethane foam, which was banned in Britain, banned in all of Europe, but used in the United States still when it shouldn't have been, definitely is the reason it turned into a disaster. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm. And just again to sort of round us out, to go back to one of the points that you made at the beginning, that there is some positive that did come out of this, because it was all the mistakes that had been made, all the things that were wrong. It was a great case study of what not to do, and as a result, changes were made, and it is safer now to be a miner than it was before May of 1972.
There's no question about that. All of those changes, the improvements in safety training, I mean, safety, there are competitions every year now all throughout the mining industry, coal and hard rock, where guys are challenged to show that they know the best in procedures and are and excellent responders in the event of a catastrophe. There was a lot of problems with Sunshine Mine because people weren't trained that way, so that's another legacy, the self-rescuers, the compartmentalized hoist rooms, all of that stuff is great. I think that, you know, there's a tragedy going on now in another part of the world, in China, where every day there are, I'm not kidding you, every day.
It's you think being a miner is dangerous any place. In China, it's the one place you don't want to be a miner. It's incredibly dangerous.
Hundreds have died this year alone, and they continue to die. And there's so much we know in America about, and Europe, you know, I mean, the Brits really wrote the book on mine safety, but all of these, you know, measures that we have, it's a sure shame we can't get the rest of the world to follow them, because a lot of lives are being lost for the very same reasons they were lost in 72 in Sunshine Mine.
Yeah. Well, it's a very dramatic story, particularly the description of what how the disaster developed, what happens, what was going on underground. I think you get a real good feeling for what it would have been like.
And it sounds like you wouldn't want to work underground.
I don't think so. I think I'll find some other line of work for myself. Greg, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
All right. Thanks, David. Thanks for having me on.
Greg Olson is the author of the book, The Deep Dark, Disaster and Redemption in America's Richest Silver Mine. It's published by Crown. You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infant-parent.com. Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Prices in the grain pits have been choppy today. Wheat has turned lower in volatile trade, pressured by Egypt canceling a tender and strength in the U.S. dollar. Meanwhile, over in the corn pit, we saw early support from continued aggressive exports, as well as U.S. Senate passage of an energy bill that would boost the use of renewable fuels, such as corn-based ethanol. But we're also seeing spillover weakness from U.S. crude oil and gold, which are lower, and a stronger U.S. dollar. Meanwhile, this morning, USDA said exporters sold just over 158,000 tons of U.S. corn to Japan for shipment in 2007-2008. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars in Kansas City December wheat at 976 down 12 and a half, July 811 down 21. At the Board of Trade, December wheat at 930 down 4, to March 945 down 8 and a half, July 787 down 20 and a half. December corn 417 down 1 3/4, March 434 and a half down a half, May 445 and a half down a half, December 448 and a quarter down 2 1/2. January beans 1149 3/4 up 3 3/4, March 1168 up 2, May 1181 and a quarter up 1 3/4, November 1052 down 2 1/2. Ed Kieser tells us a winter storm watch is in effect from Saturday morning through Sunday morning for most of Indiana, with the exception of far north, central, and far western sections. Today in northern Indiana, cloudy, with scattered snow showers and flurries. Elsewhere, mostly.